Lives of Unitarian Universalists, also known as Black Lives of UU, or Blue for short, is an organizing collective of black UUs working to expand the role and visibility of black people within our Unitarian Universalism faith. Listen to their voices. When I think of the best I've seen of Unitarian Universalism, I think of courage, of joy in POC, people of color, spaces despite it all. I think of people just showing up for one another. I think of the courage to stay at the table, to sit with discomfort instead of rushing through it. Some people call the black women leaders in the Black Lives of UU instigators, or harsh, or rude, or faith killers. I call them some of the truest Unitarian Universalists I know. Unitarian Universalism is changing. We're being more honest about ourselves and our stories, yet I have more faith in us than ever. Let's take courage and keep on working. Kenny Wiley, senior editor of UU World and founding member of Black Lives of UU. So I ask you now to stop being afraid and to lean into the power of our faith. Understand that we have set the table in an impossible way, and we must now leave that table and forge a new way. We must be bold. We must not give up. We have all that we need, and we have capable people of color who are willing to lead and cannot do it alone. The usual order and process of things have been disrupted, and my friends, this is a blessing, because that process, that order that was so comfortable, was fraught with deeply rooted and harmful problems. Let us now go together on a journey building a new way and uprooting white supremacy within our communities, in the world around us, and in our hearts. This can be a new beginning if we make it so. Lena Gardner, Executive Director of Black Lives of UU. The spiritual part of this journey means you can't worry about being right. You've got to focus on being real. Adam Lawrence Dyer, seminary student at the Pacific School of Religion. Experience open minds and hearts here today at UMIN. If you are a member or a frequent visitor here, how many times have you heard this? This month's theme is embodiment. Today's service is a wonderful opportunity for embodiment. How do we open our hearts and minds to a topic we would rather not discuss? How do we open our hearts and our minds when the first response may be to dismiss or become defensive? How do we open our minds and our hearts when we're uncomfortable? We lean into our faith and our principles. The best way to affirm the principles of our faith is to put them into practice, right here, right now. This teaching is not about blame or shame. It is about truth and reconciliation. This teaching is about listening and learning. This teaching is a call to action. This teaching is about creating a brave space, building a new way. This teaching is about moving our faith toward the beloved community we all seek. Come, experience open minds and open hearts. Yours truly, Sheila K. Smith.
In our human mission, we aspire to come together to create an environment that celebrates our differences, nurtures transformative growth, and promotes an open-minded search for truth and justice, both within our walls and beyond. Celebrating these differences, nurturing transformation in ourselves and in our world, seeking justice in our communities isn't easy work. With that understanding, some of what you will hear today may be hard to hear. Some of it may challenge you in ways that are new. If today makes you uncomfortable, we invite you to sit with the feeling, to ponder what it might teach. In the spirit of our human covenant, we ask that you open your heart and seek to understand by listening deeply, actively, to the ideas, the feelings, and the opinions expressed here. Even when, especially when, our words may challenge each other, we are called to listen with humility, to listen with love to another's truth. Pema Chodron, the Buddhist nun, reminds us that when we touch the center of sorrow, when we sit with discomfort without trying to fix it, when we stay present to the pain of disapproval or betrayal and let it soften us, these are the times when we connect with bodhicitta, our awakened heart. In bodhicitta, we let go of our attachment to beliefs and illusions and embrace what is with compassion and love. Love is the doctrine of this church, and service is its law. Whatever we do here, we do in covenant with each other.
Why in the world are we here on Mother's Day talking about white supremacy? I mean, we're UUs. We're a progressive, free-thinking lot with open hearts and open minds, right? We stand out at the roadside with our Black Lives Matter banner singing, "We Shall Overcome." Let's pause just a moment to ponder the apparent absurdity of a bunch of mostly upper-middle-class white folks standing on the side of the road singing, "We Shall Overcome." We're here today talking about white supremacy because we were asked to by an organization called Black Lives of UU. Out of the troubling controversy surrounding the hiring practices at the UUA that resulted in the resignation of UUA President Peter Morales last month, Black Lives of UU called on every UU congregation to interrupt their regularly scheduled programming and hold a teach-in on white supremacy. Human was one of almost 700 UU congregations that answered that call, because even we well-intentioned progressive UUs will fall victim to white supremacy if we do not understand it, recognize it, and actively work against it. Show of hands, who here is a racist? Anyone? Anyone? Anyone here a racist? Okay. Well, of course we're not, because racism is not a character trait that defines a certain type of person. A racist is not something that one is or is not. We need to start thinking of the word racist or racism as an adjective instead of a noun. Because we all on occasion do and say racist things, but that does not make us a racist. This is where a lot of discussions with white people about race go off the rails, because for some reason we have a hard time not personalizing racism. Don't you think that joke you told is a little racist? I'm not a racist! Racism or white supremacy, and I'm going to use the terms interchangeably here, is a historically based, institutionally perpetuated system of exploitation and oppression of peoples of color by white peoples for the purpose of maintaining and defending a system of wealth, power, and privilege. Now that's a long definition, so let me say it again. A historically based, institutionally perpetuated system of exploitation and oppression for the purpose of maintaining and defending a system of wealth, power, and privilege. White supremacy is a system of power. It is not a natural occurrence, and it didn't happen by accident. It is designed, and it is very much intentional. I found an essay online titled "What is White Supremacy?" Written by a woman named Elizabeth Martinez, and she lays out a wonderfully concise history of how white supremacy was established and ingrained in America, and so I'm going to share that with you now. Every nation has a creation myth or origin myth, which is the story people are taught of how the nation came into being. Ours says the United States began with Columbus's so-called discovery of America, continued with settlement by brave pilgrims, won its independence from England with the American Revolution, and then expanded westward until it became the enormous rich country you see today. That is the origin myth. It omits three key facts about the birth and growth of the United States as a nation. Those facts demonstrate that white supremacy is fundamental to the existence of our country. Number one, the United States is a nation state created by military conquest in several stages. The first stage was the European seizure of lands inhabited by our indigenous peoples. Before the European invasion, there were estimated somewhere between 9 and 18 million indigenous people in North America. But by the time of the end of the Indian Wars, there were about 250,000 in what is now called the United States, and only 123,000 left in what is now Canada. That process must be called genocide, and it created the land base of this country. The elimination of indigenous peoples and the seizure of their land was the first condition of white supremacy's existence. Number two, the United States could not have developed economically as a nation without enslaved African labor. When agriculture and industry began to grow in the colonial period, a tremendous labor shortage existed. Not enough workers came from Europe, and the European invaders could not put indigenous peoples to work in sufficient numbers. It was enslaved Africans who provided the labor force that made the growth of the United States possible. Now, there had been slave revolts from the beginning, but elite whites feared that discontented whites, servants, tenant farmers, the urban poor, the propertyless soldiers, and sailors, would join black slaves to overthrow the existing order. As early as 1663, indentured white servants and black slaves in Virginia had formed a conspiracy to rebel and gain their freedom. In 1676 came Bacon's Rebellion by white frontiersmen and servants along black slaves. This rebellion shook up Virginia's planter elite. The main fear of elite whites everywhere was a class fear, so their solution was to divide and control. Certain privileges were given to the white indentured servants. They were allowed to join militias, carry guns, acquire land, and have other legal rights that were not allowed to the slaves. With these privileges, they were legally declared white on the basis of their skin color and continental origin. That made them superior to black slaves and Native American Indians. Thus, whiteness was born as a racist concept to prevent lower class white people from joining people of color, especially black people, against their class enemies. This concept of whiteness became a source of unity and strength for the vastly outnumbered Euro-Americans. Today, unity across color lines remains the biggest threat in the eyes of a white ruling class. Kind of sounds like an election we had recently. The third major piece in this true story of the formation of the United States as a nation was the takeover of half of Mexico by war, today's Southwest. This enabled the U.S. to expand to the Pacific and thus open up huge trade with Asia. It also opened to the U.S. vast mineral wealth in Arizona, agricultural wealth in California, and vast new sources of cheap labor to build railroads and develop the economy. The United States had already taken over the part of Mexico we call Texas in 1836, then made it a state in 1845. The following year, it invaded Mexico and seized its territory under the 1848 Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. A few years later, in 1853, the U.S. acquired a final chunk of Arizona from Mexico by threatening to renew the war. This completed the territorial boundaries of what is now the United States. This is the last sentence of of Ms. Martinez's history, and it's really kind of encapsulates us all. The roots of U.S. racism or white supremacy lie in establishing economic exploitation by the theft of resources and human labor, then justifying that exploitation by institutionalizing the inferiority of its victims. So what do we white UUs do about white supremacy? The first thing we must do is open our hearts and minds and unlearn what we've been taught about how and why our society allocates wealth, power, and privilege the way that it does. Because what we've been taught is a lie that is white supremacy. The second thing we must do is learn to recognize white supremacy in its myriad of obvious and subtle forms. We cannot fight what we cannot see. Most of us proudly pat ourselves on our non-racist backs for denouncing the Klan and shunning the use of the N-word. But how many of us understand that the popular, well-intentioned statement, "I don't see color," says to the person of color, "I choose to overlook the difficulties you face in our society because of the color of your skin and pretend that we're treated exactly the same." Though well-intentioned, "I don't see color" is a racist statement. I saw a political cartoon recently that perfectly exemplified this point. The first panel of the cartoon was a little white boy standing at his front door calling out, "I'm going out, Mom!" And his mother responding, "Put on your jacket!" The second panel of the cartoon was a little black boy standing at his front door calling out, "I'm going out, Mom!" And his mother responding, "Put on your jacket, but not a hoodie. Don't run. Keep your hands inside at all times. Don't seem scary. Don't make any sudden moves. Keep your mouth shut around police. Don't give them a reason to hurt you. ... As progressives, we may be more tuned in to the anti-racism issues of police brutality, anti-immigration policies, school-to-prison pipeline, and other topical issues. But how often do we fall into the trap of paternalism, the white savior complex, the virtuous victim narrative, or instinctively fearing people of color? I know I am guilty of these things every day. But I am also making a conscious effort to educate myself and practice not doing these things so that each day I do and say fewer racist things than I did the day before. As the beneficiaries of the unjust power that the system of white supremacy bestows upon us, we have a choice to make every single day. We can act in ways that perpetuate that system, or we can act in ways that dismantle it. So I ask everyone here today to commit to beginning the work of dismantling it. May it be so.